Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It is another Monday morning in Trump world. Boy, there is a lot going on, both with the protests and, of course, the new polls are out. And our guest today, who better to talk to about all of this than our friend Josh Kroshauer from the National Journal, who is bringing along a little bit of ambient sound. This is great. It's June. We get to go outside. We hear the birds sing, and we figured, why not?
I'm trying to add some authenticity, Charlie. I work on the patio when it's nice out, and you can hear the birds chirping and the animals kind of rustling around. So this is my daily life, working from home every day.
Okay, so I'm a little bit jealous because I am down in the bunker, the basement bunker here. So I'm feeling very, very jealous about all of this. So there's a bunch of things I want to talk about with you, including your piece in the National Journal, where you ask the question, what's going to happen to the Republican Party after Donald Trump? There's a very interesting debate, between people saying that once Trump goes, we're done with it, versus people who say, no, this dysfunction runs too deep. And I want to get to that. I want to talk to you about what's going on at the New York Times right now, because it is kind of extraordinary. There's something going on in the media that I have to say that I didn't necessarily think would be quite as explicit as it is. And I want to talk about the whole controversy over defunding, dismantling, and abolishing the police, because I think this is a problem for Democrats. Now, it's weird for me to say there's a problem for Democrats when you have the CNN poll out showing Joe Biden not only leading Donald Trump, but leading Donald Trump by 14 points. Did you have to do a double take when you saw that?
When you see polls, Charlie, where Texas is tied, where Georgia is extremely competitive, where Trump is losing in Ohio, I mean, that we're just seeing the natural movement that we've seen for the last few weeks. And I've been writing about how this race is not all that close, and it looks like the polls are starting to come around to that analysis.
Okay, so this may be an outlier, because we've seen this before, but this poll, the CNN poll, would show real erosion in Trump's support, and so now we are at Biden is at 55% to Trump 41%. The 41% is pretty consistent with what he's been polling across the board. So I mean, there's a real pattern there. The number that really jumped out at me, 38% approval rating, because that puts him down right there at Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush category. Donald Trump with a 44-45% approval rating, I can easily see winning re-election. 38%, those are grim numbers.
Yeah, and when you look inside those numbers, Charlie, I mean, it gets even more grim for the president. He's only at a 46% job approval among men. He's only winning 37% of independents, 70% of conservatives. That's well under the Mendoza line that he needs. His own base of conservative voters, 26% disapprove of his job performance. So this isn't just the suburban moms that are moving away from the president that we've seen in past news cycles. This is some of his base. Some of the blue collar voters that swung his way to win Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. There's a reason why, the moment where the president, went to St. John's Church and held the Bible so awkwardly for a photo op, I mean, that was born out of weakness. That was born because his team had been seen polling showing even evangelical voters, which have been his most steadfast supporters throughout his whole presidency. They were slipping away a little bit. And if you don't hold your own base, there's no way you're going to win a national election in these times.
One of the things that's most striking to me about these numbers, and again, it does seem to be consistent, is the rather strong public support for these protests. There may be a backlash in the future, but we're not actually seeing it. Growing majority of Americans feel racism is a big problem in the country. More than 8 in 10 say the peaceful protests that have spread throughout the country following the death of George Floyd are justified. Americans now consider race relations as important as a campaign issue. So to the extent that Trump has been counting on the messaging of law and order, and this was all Antifa, it does look, at least for the moment, as if he's not winning that argument.
These protests are as much about President Trump as they are about George Floyd. And clearly there is the main component of civil rights and race relations. And that's those are the organizations that are organizing the protests, but they're much more diverse than protests like this in the past. And this is, you know, I said this in a column not that long ago. When you have a president that doesn't listen to the opposition, you know, you get an opposition that gets very angry and you know, you see protests to this effect. You know, the public supports the protests. They don't support violence. They don't support the riots. That's
right.
The sweet spot for any politician. And that's why Republicans have had difficulty kind of figuring out how they're going to respond to the protests. But, you know, the challenge for Democrats right now, and you alluded to this earlier, Charlie, you know, you have the base of the Democratic Party calling for defunding the police, calling, you know, or refusing to condemn rioting unequivocally. You know, even you know, Joe Biden took a few days when the riots were first raging in the last weekend to actually put out a statement condemning violence, saying that, you know, peaceful protest is okay, but any kind of looting or rioting is unacceptable. That's reflective of divisions within the Democratic Party. And when I put on my political analysis hat, you know, I don't think this really is going to change the outcome of the 2020 election. This election is going to be about Trump, and he's the guy in charge when all this chaos and all this protest and everything is going on in the streets. But, you know, I think the Democrats have a real lot, you know, they have a real conflict in their own coalition, because you've got the socialists, the Bernie bros, the leftists now speaking up and having a louder voice. But the party wins elections by winning the suburban moderates in states like Wisconsin and Georgia and, you know, all the moderate House races that Democrats won in 2018. You know, the views of the protesters, or the views of the more radical protesters, I should say, are not viewed all that favorably. So, you know, we're seeing the first wave of polling. Oftentimes, when you're in the middle of a hot news cycle,
right,
you see some movement in one direction that goes back to the middle when things calm down. You know, I think Trump is not the messenger to talk about law and order. But I think if Joe Biden wins the presidency and has to deal with his party's contradictions, the contradictions of his coalition, that could cause some serious problems. He could face some serious challenges getting anything done because of that.
Well, I want to go back to something you said here, which is really important. In the NBC poll that we saw yesterday, 80% of Americans feel that the country is out of control. So it's very difficult to be the incumbent in that environment and say that you are also the law and order president. I agree with that. So, but to your point about the lagging indicator, I do think that this amazing traction for defunding and dismantling the police is a real problem for the Democrats, exactly the way that you said. And it feels like real political malpractice, because we do have words like reform the police, reorganize the police, even demilitarize the police, find ways to restructure policing that are not as in your face as defund. I see the Washington Post. We're getting a lot of explainers like, well, defund doesn't really mean defund, and abolishing policing doesn't mean abolishing policing. Then why are you using those words? And particularly, if you're looking for language that will alienate those suburban voters, this is it. And by the way, Donald Trump gets this. He's all over this morning. I mean, you saw this, right? Sleepy Joe Biden and the radical left Democrats want to, all in caps, defund the police. I want great and well-paid law enforcement. I want law and order. And then immediately after that, he said, not only will Sleepy Joe Biden defund the police, he will defund our military. He has no choice. The Dems are controlled by the radical left. So you know that this is going to be a major theme of the Trump campaign and Republicans, who are going to try to just hang this around the neck of every Democrat in the country.
So, Charlie, remember when we talked about how Trump supporters would say, take him seriously, but not literally? I mean, that's the kind of postmodernism, the kind of like don't take words at face value that was predominant on the right. We're seeing that on the left, and frankly, in some corners of the media, that really alarm me, because, you know, as a journalist, words matter, facts matter. And when we're seeing this kind of trendy view that, you know, defund the police doesn't mean defund the police, even though listen to the Minneapolis City Council president, listen to the policies that they're advocating. Now, maybe they don't end up passing legislation that actually bans the police. I would hope not. But, you know, there's a pattern of illiberalism emerging on both sides. Extremism begets extremism. And I think, you know, it's easy in these times to take one side and to say, you know, I hate Trump, and I'm going to excuse misbehavior on the other side of the aisle. I mean, this we saw in the Democratic nominating process, the growth of sort of this worldview that isn't representative of the party, but seemingly a lot of people think it has a whole lot more adherence than it actually does. This sort of socialist worldview that Bernie Sanders advocated for, and frankly, Elizabeth Warren, and even some of the other lesser known candidates advocated for during the campaign. It didn't sell. And you talk about the issue of defunding the police. YouGov, the pollster, actually tested that argument in the last few weeks, and they only found 16% between May 29th and May 30th, so just 2 weeks ago, only 16% of Americans supported that position. Only 20% of Democrats supported that position. So,
okay, this is brilliant. But let's look at what's happening in Minneapolis. And these are the images, and they're all over conservative media right now. I mean, this is in this alternative reality. First, you had the mayor of Minneapolis come out and speak to a crowd, and they asked him, would you support, I can't remember, was it defunding or dismantling the police department? He said, no, I'm not in favor of, you know, dismantling the police. And they booed him and they yelled him and he got the F-bombs thrown at him. And you could easily dismiss that as, well, this is just a fringe group, right? Except, speaking of fringes, we're seeing now a supermajority of the Minneapolis City Council now saying that they are going to dismantle the city's police department. And then now did you saw this on CNN? There's a member of the member of the Minneapolis City Council who's on CNN, and the host asks her, are you really serious about it? Let me play the soundbite of this.
Do you understand that the word dismantle or police free also makes some people nervous? For instance, what if in the middle of the night my home is broken into? Who do I call?
Yes, I mean, I hear that loud and clear from a lot of my neighbors, and I know, and myself too, and I know that that comes from a place of privilege. Because for those of us for whom the system is working, I think we need to step back and imagine what it would feel like to already live in that reality where calling the police may mean more harm is done.
Okay, look. A position of privilege. I understand the point she's making here, but it strikes me as absurdly tone deaf to talk about a police-free future. I mean, that's not socialism. That's some sort of utopian, you know,
human
if we just or something. It's just like if we just spend enough money on social services, there will be no crime. So are we going to have abolish police, abolish prosecutors, abolish jail? We will live in a world in which there are no bad people because the human nature will be fundamentally changed by a series of social programs enacted by the Minneapolis City Council.
The difference between the liberal wing of the Democratic Party and the leftist wing of the Democratic Party is that one believes in equality of outcome. The leftists believe in the equality of outcome, and liberals believe in the equality of opportunity. And what basically this this is the city council president of Minneapolis. Okay. She's not some fringe actor. She's the head of the city council. And she basically says the ability to be protected from crime and murder and robbery and all everything that takes place in a city that makes people safe, including minorities, including people of color. It's not just white people, but any ability to be protected from crime is quote unquote white privilege. And that's, you know, basically the argument is that because some people suffer because of crime and because some people have been, you know, victims, we should bring everyone down to that level. Instead of trying to bring everyone up, we should bring everyone down. And that's just not only is that not a popular position as we were going over the polling, Charlie, but it's a profoundly illiberal position. It's not what liberals have been talking about in terms of the issues of race and crime and, you know, protecting communities that are disadvantaged. That's not a racial issue. It's an issue of fairness. And it's an issue, you know, if you look at the polling, you actually see, you know, more support among white liberals to get rid of the police and have embrace some of these ideas rather than African-Americans themselves. So, you know, there is an issue with policing. There's no doubt about it. And you said at the outset, Charlie, that, you know, Joe Biden's talking about reform. Joe Biden's talking about looking at how some of these bad cops are protected by the police unions. And we should look at how we can kind of hold bad police officers more accountable. That's in the liberal tradition. Now, frankly, that's what Democrats in Congress are currently talking about right now. But when you look at the city level and you look at the activist level, you're seeing this profoundly illiberal view that is at odds with where, you know, the mainstream of the country is.
So is Joe Biden going to have something like a sister soldier moment where he specifically says, I am not supporting defunding the police. I am not supporting the abolition of the police department or the dismantling of police. This is what I am proposing. I am proposing reorganization, rethinking of the police. I am talking about changing the laws of qualified immunity and things like that. Will he be able to do that? Or in the current environment, are Democrats afraid to take on this wing of the party? Are they afraid that there would be blowback given the emotions at the moment?
They are afraid. And look, Joe Biden is clearly within the mainstream of the Democratic Party, and everything he has said has, you know, aside from being a little late, in my judgment, to condemn violence when it was raging throughout the country, you know, I think he has been pretty spot on in terms of finding the sweet spot and talking about these very politically fraught issues. But he has been pulled to the left. I've been struck that, you know, throughout political history, candidates usually run to the base in a primary, and then when they're trying to win over the voters in the middle, they take a more pragmatic, more moderate view. Joe Biden took a pragmatic view in the primary. He actually believed a lot of these ideas were crazy, and he didn't really, you know, there were a few issues maybe where he may have moved a little leftward, but he generally didn't back down. He stood with where he was throughout his political career. What's striking now is that now that he's in a general election and he needs to win over a broader swath of voters, he is pandering to the left, the far left, in some cases. You know, he's not going to have a sister soldier moment. There are people on Twitter who would say simply that calling something a sister soldier moment or advocating for a Democrat having a sister soldier moment is itself racist, and that shows how far we've gone as a country. But I think one thing Biden might do is pick someone like Keisha Lance Bottoms, or at least consider someone like Keisha Lance Bottoms, the mayor of Atlanta, who, you know, I wrote about this a couple weeks ago, but I was struck. She was the only leading Democratic official in the midst of the chaos a couple weeks ago. And she gave this speech that went viral among Democrats, Republicans, independents. And she said, you know, what I see happening on the streets of Atlanta is not Atlanta. This is not a protest. This is not in the spirit of Martin Luther King Jr. This is chaos. So when the rioting was going on and it was at its worst and no one felt like they had the moral clarity to condemn the violence, you have this mayor of Atlanta who was already, you know, being vetted by Joe Biden and his VP team, having a real moment of leadership. And I think she is going to be on the short list now after not being considered at all or after not really being taken seriously as a leading VP candidate. I think picking someone like Lance Bottoms would send a message that Biden is looking for a much more unifying message instead of playing to the extremes.
So I need to remind you that inside, deep inside me, is still a 12-year-old boy. So I have to say, is going to be concerned about the signs Biden Bottom? I'm sorry, I can't.
Well, you could sell. I mean, Charlie, you could sell like, you know, you could sell like gym shorts with the, you know, okay, there's some opportunity there.
So you and I have spent some time talking about the sister soldier moment, and I need to remind myself that a lot of people, even smart people who listen to our podcast, might not know what that is. You know, this is 1992, and it's Bill Clinton, and Sister Soldier was a well-known rap star. And she was very openly she was a hip hop a star. And she gave an interview to the Washington Post where she said, you know, she was asked, you know, even the people themselves who are perpetrating the violence, did they think it was wise? Was this a wise, reasoned action? And she said, yeah, it was. I mean, if black people kill black people every day, why not have a week and kill white people? And she talks about killing a white person. Why not kill a white person? Do you think that somebody thinks that white people are better? And she goes on to say this. So Bill Clinton shows up in June of 1992 at a meeting of Jesse Jackson's Rainbow Coalition. And he responds and he denounces it very clearly. And Jesse Jackson was very upset about it. It was an edge. There was a real considerable political risk for Clinton to take on the activists. But it was that moment where, and it turned out, I think, to be a signature moment for Bill Clinton, when he was willing to take on, you know, extremists in his own in his own party. So that's what we mean about the sister soldier moment. Okay, so we've been talking.
Well, just really quickly, I mean, identity matters so much in our modern politics, especially on the Democratic side. So when you have an African-American woman who's accomplished, an executive, who says something that powerfully, it means a lot more than, you know, you or I saying it, or you know, the Minneapolis mayor or anyone else. Absolutely. So identity is such a driving force, especially in Democratic politics, Republican politics too, on the other extreme. And that really, you know, I think having a voice that could reach out to a really broad array of coalitions within the Democratic Party makes her a very interesting choice for Joe Biden. And I'd expect her to be on the short list.
Well, I mean, obviously she is on the short list. That's the breaking story of the day. And you know that this has been a very, very shifting list. I still think that that Kamala Harris has got to be the front runner. Just remains the front runner, if for no other reason than the fact that she's been on the national stage, and so that there are no surprises.
I think you're right. I think she's definitely the front runner. But boy, even though she seems like the obvious choice, especially if you want to diversify the ticket more, there's not a lot of love between a lot of top Biden aides. And Harris, dating back to that early debate where she essentially accused him of being racially insensitive for his past position on busing back in the 1970s. So they're going to make the most politically savvy choice. Harris, you know, on paper, she's a great pick. She checks a lot of boxes, but she's not had a great track record when it comes to actually running campaigns and underachieved pretty dramatically in the presidential primary. So, yeah, you know, has. I think she's, yeah, I think the front runner, the money is on Harris as the front runner, but I think someone like Bottoms is catching up quite steadily.
Okay. I did not want to talk about this today. I'll be honest with you. I thought that we would be done talking about the New York Times editorial board, their decision over an op-ed piece. But it's turned into something much bigger, and you made an allusion to it earlier. So since we last spoke, referring to the podcast, the top two editors on the opinion section of the New York Times have essentially been fired. James Bennett, and is it James Dow, DAO? These guys are you know, major figures in American journalism, major powers in the New York Times, and they've now lost their jobs because of the decision to run an op-ed piece by Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas, arguing that we ought to send the troops in to deal with urban unrest. There was a huge blowback among many staffers of the New York Times at the time, saying that this piece should never have been run, that it made them feel unsafe. For a few minutes, there was an attempt to throw some junior editors under the bus, including our former colleague, Adam Rubenstein, who is a great guy, very, very conscientious. I thought that was grotesquely unfair. And now, apparently, they've decided this is such a big deal that they've fired the top two editors. And I know you highlighted this, the new editor, and you may have it in front of you, the new editor that they brought in to run the opinion section basically says to everybody on the staff that if you see anything, if you see any editorial or headline or picture that gives you the slightest pause, don't hesitate to text me. And I'm you know, sort of going back saying, are you this afraid of, I mean, if you're in the opinion business, why are you so afraid of opinions? And so is this part of the illiberalism that you were making reference to earlier, Josh?
It absolutely is, Charlie. And look, the traditional liberal view of a healthy op-ed page, a solid op-ed page, is when you get to debate ideas, when you get to you know, have a healthy dialogue. And look, newspapers and magazines can set their own editorial standards. I mean, the Wall Street Journal is a generally conservative op-ed page and doesn't run a whole lot of, you know, liberal op-eds. But that's been their brand. That's what they do. The New York Times under James Bennett has, I think, for in a positive way, you know, promoted dialogue between positions that may be out of the mainstream on the left and on the right. And I actually don't think they run much, you know, hardline, you know, conservative content, but, you know, they proudly defend under James Bennett the importance of debate and discussion and dialogue. And what you're hearing from, I guess, a lot of staffers, a lot of younger staffers at the Times and in other journalistic institutions, is that we don't want to have anything that may offend us. We have the right, the veto right, to basically, you know, condemn and call for censorship of something, even if it's from a prominent Republican senator, if we feel uncomfortable with that content. And, you know, again, the New York Times has run that op-ed page has run tons of provocative, you know, what you would might consider out of the mainstream opinions, whether it's, you know, Vladimir Putin or, you know, terrorist leaders that have had space on the Times to advocate their worldview. I think there was an op-ed that Tom Cotton tweeted this out last night, but they ran an op-ed a few years ago, you know, justifying the biological nature of pedophilia. So it's not like the New York Times has shied away from provocative content. And it's not like, you know, people have screamed bloody murder when a lot of these very unpopular opinions were published on the New York Times op-ed page. It's Tom Cotton who essentially called for the military to come in and quell rioting and he wrote this. He was actually, the Times solicited his opinion on the subject because of his public comments. And, you know, and frankly, it's a position that if you look at the polling, about 40 to 50% of the country believes in and agrees with, even if you think it, and I don't agree with it personally. I think it's a little bit out there, but it's certainly within the type of dialogue that the New York Times has published for years. So, I mean, going back to your original point, Charlie, we're at this liberal moment in society where Trump calls, you know, the press that he doesn't like whenever they challenge him, they call them fake news. And you have now elite op-ed pages and staffers at these elite op-ed pages calling, you know, any content that they find insensitive, and they're calling for censorship of it. That's not a part of a hell. I mean, newspapers can choose to curate and publish whatever content they see fit. But when we're at a moment when the sensitivity to an opinion you don't like, it, you know, takes precedence over a healthy dialogue and explanation of why you disagree and the arguments back and forth, we're not in a good place in our society. That's a very illiberal position to be in. And I never thought I would hear it from staffers at one of the leading and most esteemed newsrooms in the entire country.
I mean, look, I mean, I understand various points of view on all this, but I guess I'm still part of the old school, which is that if you really think an opinion is bad, you counter with a better opinion, that you combat certain speech with other speech, and that. It's not a fireable offense to run a piece you disagree with. But the part that I think was the real tell was and you mentioned it, this whole notion that media ought to be a safe place, that the opinion, the expression of an opinion, and by the way, I completely disagree with Tom Cotton. I think that he was wrong, and I think that he was tone deaf, and I also think that his timing was terrible, you know, that it was published right about the time that the entire U.S. military was saying, we're not going to go into the streets. But the reaction of so many of the staffers was that the op-ed made them feel unsafe. And this is really the slop over from this super sensitive, politically correct culture of university campuses, where people use the argument that I don't feel safe as a way to restrict free speech. And I think this is a dangerous trend. And I think this is the illiberal trend that's coming out. I think it was, I can't remember who it was who tweeted it out. It was maybe Barry Weiss, who said something like, you know, remember when people thought, you know, all of these snowflakes we have in university campuses are in for a big surprise because they're going to get out into the real world and they're going to find out that the, you know, real world doesn't care as much about their feelings as their campus does. In fact, the opposite has happened. A lot of the folks have come out of these campuses, these hyper hothouse environments, and they've imposed their views on the rest of society, including, rather remarkably, American journalism. But again, the New York Times has every right to run or not run any op-ed piece, but to see guys with the record of James Bennett and Mr. Dow lose their jobs over this is just really extraordinary. It is amazing. Okay, so I want to talk about your latest Against the Grain, because I think this is a fact, and I don't know where I come down on this. So I'm going to play devil's advocate, okay? So that you argue that Republican loyalty to Trump will not survive a November loss. But you note that this is, you know, there's a debate about all of this. You know, you have people like Ann Applebaum and George Will, who thinks the Republican Party will fairly quickly turn away from Donald Trump. You know, I mean, this is what Will said. You quote him. I'm fairly confident that Trump will be defeated. The next morning, a lot of Republicans will say, Trump, I don't recognize the name. They'll get over this fairly fast. And Applebaum makes a similar point. And then, of course, my colleague at the Bulwark, Jonathan Last, makes the counterargument. He says that this is here to stay, that even though Donald Trump may not be president, he says the error that Applebaum makes is she views Trump's hold on power to be the power of the presidency. I would argue that Trump's tenure as president is an accident that is incidental to his real seat of power, ownership of the Republican Party. And he would argue that Donald Trump and the Trumpists will still be around. They will still have a grievance lobby. They will still be immensely influential. And that the Republican Party itself has been so deeply corrupted that it just doesn't go away. So tell me what side of this debate you come down and why you think that Republicans would be able to turn the page.
So, you know, I take the middle ground view between Applebaum and Last, and Jonathan, I think, kind of hit the nail on the head in one way in his column, because it's really about the voters of the Republican Party, not about the president, not the power of the presidency. It's about what Republican voters do if the president loses badly in November. And look, I mean, history, you know, we tend to think we're kind of in a moment separate from traditional political history. But, you know, losing first term or one term presidents have a horrible track record of remaining relevant after they're out of office. And, you know, I know Donald Trump is no George H.W. Bush or Jimmy Carter, but he's not going to have the ability. Yeah, he's not going to be able to kind of, you know, outside of his Twitter feed, he doesn't hold the levers of power. He wouldn't hold the same levers of power that he does or does currently as president. And, you know, I think we might actually get to a moment if the president lost to where we were, you know, back in the days of the Wisconsin primary of 2016, when Trump was clearly, you know, he clearly had the hold of a, you know, 35-40% of the party, but there was still a lot of establishment minded voices and more moderate Republicans that were still very wary of him. And look, if Trump is defeated and Republicans see that you know, it's really going to be hard to win any elections in the future if they stick to Trump's Twitter, you know, stick to the message on Trump's Twitter feed, you're going to see more Republicans breaking away. That doesn't mean that they're going to condemn Trump. It doesn't mean that you're going to have this, you know, moment that Ann Applebaum sort of insinuates that there's going to be like a Vichy moment where people condemn the people who betrayed the party. But I think, you know, political parties are very adaptive. We saw that with Trump, and it took, you know, the blink of an eye to see a Republican Party that stood for traditional conservative principles become a Trumpian vehicle. Well, when Trump is out of office and out of power and perhaps discredited by a large swath of voters, that's going to, you know, register to a lot of Republican elected officials as well. And yes, he may have, you know, the megaphone of Twitter. He may have a, you know, a talk show or something. And he's going to have a hold on some Republican voters. The question is how much, how many? And right now, 90% or so of Republicans view the president favorably. Even if that number drops 20 points, 30 points to 60-70%, that's a tidal wave. That's a big shift. And I think that would give the Republican Party a lot of space to reorient itself in the wake of a possible political drubbing.
Well, what if a Trump is on the ballot in 2024? I mean, let's assume that he loses the election. Let's assume it's not an overwhelming landslide. First of all, Donald Trump himself could run, if you want a dystopian view, or Donald Trump the lesser could also run. And then the question is, which leading figure in the Republican Party would be willing to go up against him and win?
I mean, that is a scenario. And from what I hear out of the White House, it's a pit of vipers with a bunch of, you know, opportunistic Republicans trying to figure out their own political futures, whether it's Mike Pence or Mike Pompeo or Nikki Haley outside of the White House now. Everyone's going to be trying to figure out what is the, how do you kind of recreate Trumpism? How do you get a message that doesn't tick off Trump but looks past the last 4 years? And I think there's still, I mean, look, listen to the silence of Republicans, the Republican senators. Casey Hunt, my friend and colleague, former colleague at MSNBC, had Amazing. A great segment last week where she interviewed dozens of Republican senators walking to their weekly meeting, and none of them wanted to address what Trump was saying about the protests, and none of them wanted to talk about it. They were profoundly uncomfortable. That's a big shift, Charlie. That's not something that, you know, there have been moments like that, but the politics are changing. And when you lose an election, when you're down by 14 points, when you're down, you know, at least by 7 points in the most favorable poll, the politicians adapt. And Republicans aren't going to be on a suicide mission going forward. The reason that they're for Trump right now is they can't afford to be against Trump and have any chance of winning an election, even in a blue state. Yeah. That incentive structure, there's a good chance that'll change if he's not president. And the question is how much and how quickly.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're right. There won't be a sudden break, but they will. They won't have to show him the abject loyalty. So Ben Sasse being an early indicator of what might happen, he survived his primary and he's now becoming more critical. He'd gone from being a critic to being a silent water carrier, and now he's back.
Yeah, Ben Sasse, I mean, I think that's a leading indicator. I don't think everyone's going to be like Ben Sasse and, openly criticize the president now that he's got his primary out of the way. And frankly, I talk to a lot of people in the anti-Trump movement who don't forgive Sasse for basically, muting his criticism and defending the president when he had a primary to deal with. So, I mean, he may not be the best advocate, though it seems like he's plotting in that direction to prepare for a post-Trump future. But look, the other governor, the Republican governors that are free of Washington and have struck an independent pose. And I'm not just talking about the blue state governors. I'm talking about, you know, someone like a DeSantis or someone who's governed a red state and steered clear of some of the bitter and tribal politics in Washington. And look, you know, we're 4 years away, and that's a lifetime in politics. Yeah. So I
think the most insightful point you make, though, is what's going to heal the Republican Party. Your last paragraph, if back in power Democrats overreach governing to appease vocal left wingers when their coalition depends on support from suburban moderates, the Republican Party won't have a difficult time recreating itself as a vehicle to stop the worst excesses of a Biden administration. That's the way the politics work. And in many ways, that's sort of the natural nature of conservatism, is to be reactionary in that, right? That's sort of what they're most comfortable. So in this context of this weekend did feel, and it was awfully interesting, that New York Times piece that talked about the number of Republicans who are saying that they won't vote for Trump. George H.W. Bush won't vote for Trump. Colin Powell won't vote for Donald Trump. Looks like Cindy McCain might even endorse Joe Biden. Talk to me about this. Does this matter, or is this just sort of the, you know, again, the expected reaction of the Republican elites?
Does it matter? It matters when you have the entire past Republican leadership, you know, whether it's past presidents, the wife of a former presidential nominee, the military leaders, when they say that they can't vote for the Republican president. Does it change? I mean, does it change the trajectory of the race a whole lot? No. I mean, the people who like Trump like him because he takes on those very establishment figures. They like the fact that he doesn't, you know, hew to what's proper and what's, you know, considered conventional behavior in Washington. So, you know, keep in mind, he's down 14 points. A lot of the disaffection that Republicans have registered with him have already been priced into the results. A lot of those Republicans that were critical of the president in 2016 are now self-described independents who don't affiliate with the Republican Party anymore. So, yeah. I mean, I don't think it's going to have a dramatic impact, but I don't think it's going to help him build more support from the moderates and the suburbanites and the mainstream voters that have already begun to defect towards him en masse.
And each one gives cover to other people who had never thought that they'd vote for a Democrat to do it. I actually was talking to somebody who said, to hear the fact that George W. Bush is going to vote for Biden. He hasn't actually said that, but that it makes it easier to do. And then you get paragraphs like this one from the New York Times piece. Former Republican leaders like the former speakers Paul Ryan and John Boehner won't say how they will vote. And some Republicans who are already disinclined to support Trump are weighing whether to go beyond backing a third party contender to openly endorsing Mr. Biden. And then we get to the, I think, very interesting phenomenon of all the retired military leaders who have guarded their private political views are increasingly voicing their unease. This parade of generals has really goes to the heart of the Trump brand. And if maybe nothing is going to shake that white working class male support for Donald Trump, but if it does, it would be the people in the military saying, you know, no, this is not the guy we wanted our commander in chief. That I can see affecting Trump at the margins.
Here's the big question, Charlie. Will Paul Ryan or John Boehner, will they come out for Joe Biden? I mean, they're saying that they can't vote for Trump. Will they come out for Joe Biden, or will their friends in the party basically keep them on the sidelines? And the other big question is,
well, I think Boehner probably will, but I don't think the Ryan will, because I think that it would be like taking, you know, swallowing a hand grenade if you have won any future in the Republican Party to actually endorse Biden. You can survive staying silent. I'm not sure you can survive if you have a long future. Boehner is at the bleep it stage of his life, right? He doesn't care anymore. Yeah. Ryan, I'm not sure. I can imagine a conversation. He'd be on the phone with Reince Priebus saying, just don't do this. You can't do this. You can stay silent. You can withhold the endorsement, but you just can't endorse Biden. So Well, that's my prediction. So,
well, I just need to say, remember, John Boehner actually back in the primary attacked Ted Cruz and actually sort of excused Donald Trump. But I can't remember the exact quote, but he said he'd prefer Trump over Cruz at the end of that primary campaign. So I don't know. I mean, it's very possible that someone like Boehner defects because he's not in politics anymore. But until I see someone who actually voted for Trump and supported Trump in 2016 and defected in 2020 and actually is voting for Joe Biden, that's when you'll see the sea change. That's when you'll see a big movement.
So I am sort of fascinated by the dark arts of anti-Trump Republicans, and people are starting to notice that some of the anti-Trump Republicans who are supposed to be so completely irrelevant have some of the best ads up there, the Lincoln Project, that group of Republican voters against Trump, which I'm sort of I'm not affiliated with, but I mean, they're our cousins. I work with some of those folks, and their ads are absolutely fantastic. And people are noting that, you know, the Republicans against Trump and the Lincoln Project are turning out ads that are better anti-Trump ads than anything the Democrats have up right now. And it's kind of interesting because, of course, all of those premature obituaries about the irrelevance of Never Trump were out there. But I think that there's something to the fact that it's the anti-Trump Republicans have a different edge to them. I mean, maybe the part of that secret sauce is that they really have lived with and understand Trump's bullshit and the soft spots that he has with certain kinds of voters. And they don't have to check the ideological boxes that Democrats do. They're much freer to throw some of these roundhouse punches.
Yeah, I mean, and you guys have now Mike Murphy working and putting together one of the strongest ads I've seen so far this election year, attacking Trump and just clipping together the worst moments of the last 4 years. You know, one thing about the elite, you know, people condemn the elites of both parties, but that's where the talent is. I mean, unless you believe in this world where, you know, nothing is elite, and, you know, a lot of the best Republican operatives, strategists, advisors didn't want to work in this Trump White House. You know, it's been hard for the president to hire a lot of really good people. And I think incompetence has been the defining feature of the Trump presidency, even more than malpractice or this fear of a totalitarian regime, you know, emerging from the craziness. And, you know, when you have someone like, I mean, when you don't have good people working in the White House, you're going to see the types of behaviors you do on a daily basis. But on the other hand, like, a lot of the folks working in the anti-Trump Republican space are a lot of the talent talented exiled, you know, strategists that are, you know, Mike Murphy, I think, is one of the best in the business. And there are a lot of others that are part of. Tim Miller is, I've known him for a long time, and he's been writing great provocative essays at your shop at the Bulwark. So, I mean, that ultimately, like, the fact that the Trump White House hasn't been able to get the best and the brightest in the Republican world has shown. I mean, that just talent matters, merit matters, and it shows with this administration.
I had to laugh at that Axios report about the meetings at the White House where they were saying that, I'm simplifying this, that we needed to have Trump needed to find a sort of a kinder, gentler, more unifying message to go forward. Yeah, that's really going to work. But do people actually listen to yourselves? Because yes, he does need to have that message, but he's Donald Trump and nothing is going to change. And so he's even tweeting. This is interesting to me that he felt the need to tweet out an attack on Roger Goodell, the commissioner of the NFL, who basically said, hey, you know, we need to listen to more. We needed to have listened more carefully to African Americans who took a knee. He had to mock Goodell, and then he had to make fun of Mitt Romney for marching in this peaceful demonstration. So any you know, latent belief that the president was going to be, it's so ridiculous. I mean, like, look, he is who he is. It's never going to get any better. It's never going to get nicer. It's never going to get kinder. It's never going to become less petty.
We're now like in season 7 of The Apprentice. And if you remember, the ratings for The Apprentice in its first few seasons were great and, you know, revolutionized prime time at NBC. But then they declined as people got sick of the same old stories and the same old games. And that's what we're seeing right now in the Trump presidency. The staples, fire Colin Kaepernick, the whole division on cultural and racial lines, the playbook that Trump has used year after year, day after day. People have grown kind of tired of that shtick, and it doesn't work like it did a couple years ago, and people want change. I mean, even people who don't agree with where Democrats are right now, they want Trump out of office, and then they'll deal with the craziness there, you know, the other issues that they have after that. But, you know, that's his political conundrum, that, you know, his tricks, the divisive tricks that he's used, sometimes to good effect, or sometimes to effect, you know, to positive effect for his own political standing, that people are getting tired of that, and his numbers are declining, and even the base is starting to wonder, like, what's going on.
Exactly. Josh Krasher, thank you so much for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast and being with us on what seems like an awfully interesting Monday morning.
Lots to talk about, Charlie. It was great being on the show.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.